From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Minnesota Democratic Senator Al Franken, facing insurmountable criticism from his own party, said today he will resign in the coming weeks. 35 Senate Democrats called for Franken to step down yesterday after an eighth woman accused him of sexual misconduct. Here's Franken today on the Senate floor.
I will continue to stand up for the things I believe in as a citizen and as an activist. But Minnesotans deserve a senator who can focus with all her energy on addressing the challenges they face every day.
Elizabeth Dunbar is a reporter at Minnesota Public Radio. And Elizabeth, he said her energy, it's expected the Democratic governor of Minnesota will name his lieutenant governor, Tina Smith, to this seat.
Correct. That's what a lot of the political insiders are saying. Yeah. Tina Smith is very experienced and well-respected.
Yeah, and then an election will follow. So Al Franken, former Saturday Night Live writer, creator of characters like Stuart Smalley, you know, I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, gosh darn it, people like me. He said he created that character based on people he met at Al-Anon meetings. This is for children of alcoholics. People in Minnesota did seem to like him. How is this news being received there?
Well, in the days leading up to this decision, boy, Minnesota Democrats were really split. A lot of Democrats were standing by him, said he should not resign, especially when there are Republicans holding office. There's a Senate candidate in Alabama who has a good chance of becoming a senator who have allegations against them as well. So a lot of people didn't want him to take that step, but others said he should do the right thing and step aside.
Well, he alluded to some of this today in his speech on the Senate floor. He talked about how the president had bragged of groping women. He used his own words, and he alluded to Roy Moore. Tell us more about what he said. Defiant at times, humble at others?
Yeah, it was a really somber speech. And he was defiant that none of the allegations that have come up happened when he was a senator. He was very clear about that he wanted to make clear that he never brought dishonor to the institution. But that said, I mean, he has this other past, and it was, you know, a challenge for him. There were a lot of things that came up in his original Senate campaign that people were questioning his behavior, just, you know,
He did take that photo, or at least a woman alleges that she took a photo with him when he was a senator, and that he groped her during that photo.
Right, and he on the Senate floor today denied that. Some people were really surprised that he was that defiant about his behavior. And, you know, there were women that we had calling in saying they were disappointed that he didn't take more responsibility for his behavior.
Yeah, he said some of the allegations were not true. So we mentioned that there will be someone appointed to take a seat, then there will be a special election. Are people also nervous about that? Minnesota, you know, Hillary Clinton squeaked by, you know, considering how Minnesotans have voted in the past. Is there a concern that Democrats might lose the seat, or might they have lost it if he stayed?
I think there is some concern. You know, Democrats have dominated statewide elections in Minnesota since 2008 when Franken was elected. Senator Amy Klobuchar has done very well and is very popular. We have a Democratic governor who is in his second term. Hillary Clinton did win 2016, but mm-hmm. barely. Mm-hmm. And so that's the question here. We already have heard from Republican operatives that say they're confident that they can take the seat in 2018.
He also today, Senator Franken, soon to be former Senator Franken, talked about how he really was convinced that this is something that should go through to the Ethics Committee, that he felt, you know, he offered himself up on day one for the Ethics Committee to make the decision, but then bowed to the pressure from those around him. What does he do now?
That's a good question. You know, he kept on reiterating every time there was a new allegation, I'll go through the Ethics Committee. But he said on the Senate floor today that it was becoming too much of a distraction, and that if he really did have to go through that Senate ethics investigation, that would take away from the work he was doing for Minnesotans. And that seemed to be at least the way that he thought about it and came to the decision.
Right.
What he does now, he said he's going to remain active politically and talk about the things that he cares about. So we'll just have to see what that looks like.
He also might have bowed to the pressure from the Democrats to be part of their case that they will make maybe in the 2018 elections, that their accused stepped down, John Conyers, earlier this week. The Republicans did not. Minnesota Public Radio's Elizabeth Dunbar, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, wildfires raging in Southern California have forced more than 100,000 people from their homes, and many thousands more are on edge today as the flames surround many communities. Joining us now is Alex Cohen, who is covering the story with KPCC in Pasadena. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Jeremy.
And let's start with the largest fire in Ventura County between Los Angeles and Santa Barbara. What's the latest there?
This is the so-called Thomas Fire, which broke out on Monday night. The latest numbers, 96,000 acres burned. That fire, roughly 5% contained. And the most recent and unfortunate news that we've received from that area was that a body has been discovered near the burn area. It's unclear. This does not seem to be a direct connection to the fire, but it may have been someone trying to evacuate from the scene of the fire. Mm.
Meanwhile, the Skirball fire started yesterday next to the 405 freeway and spread into the L.A. neighborhood of Bel Air. What's happening with that one?
That one is significantly smaller, and luckily the numbers there have held overnight. That one also 5% contained. It's burned roughly 475 acres. Thankfully, no serious injuries there to either civilians or firefighters, but you've got roughly 700 homes that have been evacuated from the area.
And by the way, there was a big fire in Bel Air back in 1961. Did that lead to any changes in emergency preparation there?
It was a truly amazing fire on a number of counts. You're right, Jeremy. This was back in 1961. That one destroyed more than 500 homes, including the homes of some notable celebrities, Burke Lancaster, Zsa Gabor. You had Vice President Richard Nixon, who evacuated with his wife from their rented home in the area. And as you mentioned, that led to some really big changes regarding laws trying to prevent wildfires. A lot of those laws had to do with the materials used for roofing. You had a roofing industry that lobbied hard against it, but eventually there were changes, and many credit those changes as being a reason why we haven't seen more destruction due to wildfires in the decades since.
So what are people being told today about what they should do? We talked about the fact that there are 100,000, more than 100,000 people who have been forced from their homes.
The big factor today, Jeremy, is the weather. Last night, millions of people, myself included, at about 8:30, got a loud buzz on our phone that didn't stop. That's usually what we get for amber alerts for missing kids. It was a wind warning saying that the wind is expected to be very strong. We've heard various reports, but some are calling hurricane strength winds 80 miles per hour or more. So people are being told to stay alert, stay vigilant, and more than anything, to evacuate when they're told to do so.
And are people listening to that call to evacuate when they're told to do so?
A lot of them are. There have been evacuation centers set up in all of the areas where there are fires, but there are still some holdouts. You mentioned the Skirball fire. There were just announcements this morning that some people are not heeding those calls. And in some areas, it gets really complicated. Some of these areas are very rural. You've got people who have horses at home and multiple animals, and it's not sometimes just so easy to grab the photo albums and the ID papers and just jump in the car. So people are trying to kind of triangulate that decision, which is hard to do because things are changing very quickly. A number of minor fires have also broken out in Southern California this morning, so there's a lot to pay attention to.
Well, tell us about those, because I was hearing an official say this morning that the winds would be so strong today that even a little spark could start a new fire. What do we know about the new, smaller fires that have started up?
any little spark, as you mentioned, really could start a fire. And it's amazing, Jeremy. It seems like every time you blink, a new one has cropped up. I'm looking now at a report of a 3-acre brush fire that broke out this morning near the interchange of the 15 and 60 freeways. This is in an area out east called the Harupa Valley. Mm. Thankfully, firefighters able to stop the flames there. Another fire, this one, an industrial fire that happened in the city of Anaheim. Folks might know that is the home to Disneyland. This was reported in a single-story building. And the problem, too, that you have is resources, right? They're stretched so thin at this point with so many fires in so many different areas that when these smaller fires crop up, you don't have quite the same resources that you might usually have otherwise.
Just a few seconds left here, Alex, but I imagine traffic is kind of a nightmare today.
Traffic has been pretty extreme. The 101 freeway along the coast was closed overnight. It opened up this morning once again. Some of the latest reports I saw, 2 hours delay at least.
That's Alex Cohen at KPCC in Pasadena with the latest on the fires in Southern California. Alex, thank you.
My pleasure.
It's here and now, and I've been watching a terrific new show about being a young, struggling, single mom. In fact, single mom is in the title, but that's about all we can tell you about the title. And it's going to be tough to talk about the show because it is raw, but it's real. But it may not be for everyone, a warning there. The new Showtime comedy is SMILF, Single Mother I'd Like to Whatever. It's a slur that creator Frankie Shaw decided to reclaim. She stars as Bridget Bird, raising her son Larry, named after basketball great Larry Bird, in South Boston, which has been a favorite of filmmakers. But Frankie Shaw's Southie is integrated. Her character's child is biracial. Raffi, her ex and little Larry's father, wants to help raise him while trying to stay sober. Bridget's mom, played by Rosie O'Donnell, takes care of little Larry and is suspicious of his parents' relationship.
I was thinking we could take Larry, we go down to Joseph's, we get him a cookie, you know, because I think he really needs to feel loved.
He does feel loved.
I know, I'm just saying with Raffi, the relapse and all.
Mom, he's been sober for over a year, okay? I mean, he does bedtime every night.
Oh, really? Well, he shows up for what, a whole 10 minutes?
It's
not nothing to brag about.
Bridget Bird has that hair clipped up, too skinny look of a harried south of blue collar mom, balancing childcare with acting auditions and her dream of playing pro basketball. Frankie Shaw taps into her past for it. Her mom and aunts and grandma grew up in Southie. And Frankie not only stars in SMILF, she writes, directs, and executive produces the show. She joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, you know, I say this is a well-trod South Boston, and we go back to Good Will Hunting, but you said you wanted to do a different South Boston. How so?
You know, I think we've become really accustomed to the gangster movies of Southie, you know, The Departed, and a bunch of the Affleck brother movies. And so we don't really see the women in Southie, and it's the women in Southie that I know. And so I thought it'd be great to have that as part of the fabric of the show.
And what did you want to say about these women?
I mean, it's really sort of blue-collar women in general. And it was important that we are talking about class struggle within the struggle of single motherhood. And one thing that I notice about my family, who is very Southie, is that in times of crisis, they come together. But then on the other hand, we also are exploring some of the darker elements, you know, with my mom in the show, played by Rosie O'Donnell. She has bipolar disorder, and so she's dealing with the ups and downs of that. And there's something about grandparents that where they can show up for their grandkids in a way that they couldn't show up for their own children.
Yeah. Well, and you also have Connie Britton, the fabulous actress from Nashville, playing a mother in the suburbs with three teens. You're the tutor for the family, and this is a very wealthy family. She also has struggles.
Yeah, we talk a lot about trauma and how that has affected these different women. So with Connie Britton's character, you'll notice in episode 2, she dissociates for a minute and she sort of stares off and Bridget's trying to get her attention.
Allie. Sorry. Oh, yes, this is what I was thinking of. Casey!
She's dealing with her own issues in her past and it was just important that we're sort of going deeper with all of the women.
Issues of, well, everybody has eating disorders. Yeah, I love this.
Food addiction.
Food
addictions.
There's one scene where sitting around with your character is in an eating disorders 12-step group.
Yeah.
Your character is skinny but stuffs junk food. But then there's also another character who's very overweight, and she ends up making money by making YouTube videos for men who can watch her eat. Did you ever really hear that?
Yeah, that's a real thing. It's called eater feeder porn, actually. It's pretty disturbing. The eater is the woman and the feeder is the man. And they make these videos of the man who's normally pretty normal looking, average sized, and he'll be feeding her. And the goal is to get her so big that she can't leave her room. It's like sort of a weird twist on empowerment.
Well, because your character rationalizes it by saying, hey, all I have to do is eat. It's not like it's sex or anything. So she feels she's in control of it, but
it's still under the guise of objectifying women.
Right.
Part of that story was how we're implicit in this bigger conversation that we're all having now with women being used for sex or sidelined by, you know, just being used for their body or how attractive they are or that being their worth.
Right. There's another scene. It's a very interesting relationship that develops between you, your ex, your child's father, and his new girlfriend, who at first seems clueless, like she doesn't understand, as you are looking on as the mom, what it feels like to have a new girlfriend playing with your child. But then something interesting develops, like a friendship. You also, in real life, became pregnant, moved to Los Angeles, and you were a struggling single mom. Is that something from your life?
Yeah, it was really important to me not to pit these two women against each other. You know, in my real life, my son's stepmom is an actress. And yes, there are difficulties figuring out how to co-parent. You know, as a mom, you know, I'm like, oh, what's going on at the other house? How is my son being talked to and treated, especially when he was younger? And just that sort of fear of, are her own biological children getting more attention than my own kid? Like, all of those things are real and do exist. But the thing that we did differently, or at least seems to be unexpected given the reaction that this relationship's getting in the show, is we're constantly talking. We are honest with each other. When we do have an issue or concern, we have family meetings where we talk about all of this. And at the heart of it, we all want what's best for our children. And I think if that's driving the relationship, we can sort of put our own personal issues aside.
Yeah.
The other thing I want to say about the food stuff is, you know, there's like a big connection between sexual trauma and food issues. Bridget is a survivor of childhood sexual abuse, and that is connected to her eating disorder. And yeah, she might not be overweight, but it's food addiction is a very real thing for her.
Mm. Well, and we come to know this abuse in the most kind of shocking way. She has gone to an audition for a public service announcement about PTSD. In fact, I'm wondering if you pulled this from, you've said you had an audition for Breaking Bad and you couldn't find a babysitter. So you had to bring your son. She brings her son as well, and she gets the job after this truly, really good crying scene that you do. And they're congratulating her on getting this job and saying, how'd you do that? And she blurts out, oh, I was sexually abused by my dad.
Yeah, I have been to war. Yeah.
And thank you, I got the job. I'm so excited. I mean, it was jarring.
Well, there's something about the character where she gets in her own way. She gets this win and then immediately self-sabotages by, you know, not having any boundaries and too much TMI. But the other thing that is important to us is that we're dealing with issues that are normally swept under the rug. So we're going to talk about things in an open way, in the way that they actually happen. And so that's part of maybe Bridget's charm and also her downfall. Mm. Is that she does talk too much and she just assumes everyone's her best friend when they're not.
Well, talking about these real issues, one is absolutely ripped from the headlines. We remember when Cam Newton, the Carolina Panthers quarterback, told a reporter it was funny to hear a question from her, a woman. Your character, your husband's girlfriend, is a sports reporter, and she has almost that exact exchange with a player in a parking lot when she's doing some of her television reporting. Let's listen.
Is it safe to say your move to slot receiver is a new phase of your career?
What, you're like an expert on slot receiving, huh?
Excuse me?
No, it's just funny hearing a female talk like that.
Let me ask you about, I mean, obviously we're in this moment in time where you taped this before this explosion of sexual harassment cases. And sex and sexuality is such a big part of this show. And your character wanting to feel that she still has some, you know, even though she's this harried single mom. And there's that interesting kind of juxtaposition, this moment of revealing sexual harassment and women being objectified, and this young woman going out and grabbing every young man, you know, from the corner store because she wants to explore her sexuality.
Yeah, well, I'm not putting on her that she's a harried single mom who shouldn't have sex, right? So
right,
I'm coming
right.
from her point of view, which is I'm a 28-year-old woman who wants to be sexually active, who wants to be intimate with somebody. Sometimes it's also to prove a point, like in episode 4 when she's trying to pick up a guy the way guys pick up women. She puts garbage bags in her crotch to make like a pretend bulge, and then she goes and hits on a guy. And that sort of sex scene was like, oh, what it would be like to hit on someone if I, you know, was taking on the persona of a dude.
You are prettier than you know. And I have always wanted to learn how to use one of these. Ken.
That's my name.
It's a beautiful name.
Thank you.
And just tell us a little more about the other storyline. I mean, one is about reclaiming owning sexuality, and the other is of sexual harassment and abuse.
Yeah, you know, I don't know one woman who hasn't experienced some sort of sexual violence on some level or another. And this was something we talked a lot about in the writer's room, and it was important for us to show it the way we knew it. This was all before all the hashtag Me Too, which has been such an incredible thing to witness as we are premiering the show to the world, just how they've lined up. There seems to be a solidarity now among men and women, sticking up for women and saying that this is not okay. And so we are given a voice in a time that we've always previously been silenced.
Look, this has got to be so much work. But how much fun are you having? It feels like there's, you know, no storyline, including your own love of basketball. You played basketball.
Yeah.
And your character plays basketball. What a dream.
It is such a dream. I mean, it's so much work, and every minute I can say I love doing it.
Doesn't get better than that.
Yeah.
That's actor, writer, director, executive producer Frankie Shaw. Her new show is Smilf. Frankie, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Up every day at 6, bacon and eggs to fix.
It's a song from Smilf's great soundtrack. Showtime has just renewed the show for a second season. It's here now. So you think your commute is expensive? Gas, tolls, bridges? Well, on just a 10-mile stretch of I-66 in Virginia outside D.C., the price of a new toll for express lanes hit $40 during rush hour. The peak today was around $25. But wait, it will change every 6 minutes based on a system that estimates demand. And officials say, if you don't want to pay for it, well, carpool. Put just one other person in your car and it will be free. Robin Farzad is the host of Full Disclosure on NPR One. Robin, this is called tolling. The cost is calculated using something called dynamic pricing. Explain how that works.
Yeah, what's your pain point? What's your willingness to pay? I mean, the Beltway is just a parking lot. On many days at these hours, it's useless. And when, for example, I live in Central Virginia, and when I need to be in D.C., I am very willing to pay that $23 rate that sometimes the express lane costs me just to have a working highway, because the alternative is just being stuck in traffic for 3 hours. So this is actually bringing it out there and codifying it and saying, if you want the privilege of just being the lone person in your car, you're going to have to pay for it big time.
Yeah. And by the way, you said Beltway. This is the Beltway. This is what they're talking about. You know, inside the Beltway is Washington, D.C. Well, people aren't happy. There's the hashtag highway robbery. A prominent Republican in the state's House of Delegates said the tolls were supposed to average $6 to $7. But that was outside rush hour. And explain the thinking here.
Yeah, I mean, the idea is if you could, you know, this in this really peak time, and that $40 rate, by the way, talks about almost like a 10-minute period where dynamic pricing happens, and they realize we could tweak it up. And then at what point are you crying uncle? Because I don't believe the goal here is fundraising. It's to dissuade people from riding alone. It's to incent people to take mass transit and to take other routes.
Well, where does the money go? Is it all going to the state?
I mean, $18 million a year, it's not that much in the grand scheme of funding for the state. That's the estimate for the first year. You've had more ambitious projects like congestion pricing in Manhattan, which is also you can't get in and out of Manhattan at rush hour. That was knocked down by the other boroughs. Really, it's behavior that they're trying to incent here. In theory and in practice, you would take the money and plow it not just into extra lanes for the highway, but a better mass transit system inside Virginia. You know, I live in central Virginia, and the Staples Mill Richmond station is one of the most decrepit. Like, you, they have billboards actually urging you not to use it during Thanksgiving. So what is my alternative if I can't afford the $40 lane, if I can't afford, you know, a train? I can't take a boat to D.C.
No, but I guess they're saying grab somebody, find somebody, and put them in the car with you. Look, you say the idea, the whole idea is to reduce traffic. They say that we don't have the money to keep repaving the roads from overuse. They're in gridlock anyway. So is it working? Is it reducing congestion?
You have seen it work so far this week. They're saying that average commute times have been slashed. You have seen it work in other cities. I've seen it in my hometown, Miami, in SoCal, where the 405, Southern California and 101, they are parking lots for much of the day. In Boston, I mean, you guys know this really well with the Mass Pike in Atlanta. This is the future, like it or not. And they're trying to induce people. You see it in Uber with ride sharing and pool and the lower price in that, that if you want the privilege of riding alone, which is increasingly becoming an exorbitant thing to do, you're going to have to pay for it.
Well, don't wander onto I-66 if you don't want to pay that $40 that sometimes. Robin Farzad, host of Full Disclosure on NPR One, thanks so much for telling us about it.
Thank you, Robin.
Secretary of State Rex Tillerson's trip to Europe this week has been overshadowed by questions about his job security. In Brussels yesterday, he was asked directly about reports that President Trump is going to replace him.
You know, this is a narrative that keeps coming up about every 6 weeks. And I would say y'all need to get some new sources because your story keeps being wrong.
Nancy McEldowney spent 30 years in the State Department, including a stint as ambassador to Bulgaria. She retired in June as director of the Foreign Service Institute, where she was in charge of all State Department training. She's now at Georgetown University and joins us from Washington. Welcome.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And first of all, let's start with that question. Do you think President Trump is going to replace Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State?
Well, there's only one person who knows the answer to that question, and that is President Donald Trump. The reason the issue has come up, of course, is because there were a number of sources in the White House who said that was the case. But there's another thing that's going on, and that is the fact that people are so concerned about a number of decisions that Rex Tillerson has taken in the State Department.
Decisions like basically allowing a lot of people to leave without replacing them, kind of dismantling the State Department.
Exactly right. People are concerned that Tillerson's management decisions about cutting the budget by one-third, reducing the workforce by 8%, is gutting our diplomatic capacity. And very respected figures like former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright has described this as a national security emergency.
Well, you described Tillerson and his State Department as a toxic, troubled environment and organization when you retired. That's what you told the New York Times.
I did, and I felt very sad that that was the case, but unfortunately, it's true. And there are a number of other factors that I think validate that judgment. There was recently a survey of government workers that was done across the federal government. The State Department had the largest single-year drop of any agency across the federal government. That's hugely significant. And the fact that Rex Tillerson was in Europe saying the State Department hasn't skipped a beat, but in fact, he was speaking in a place where there aren't ambassadors. There are three ambassadorial positions in Brussels. Only one of them is filled. There are positions across the State Department in Washington and around the world that are empty despite the mounting crises.
Well, he was also there in Europe yesterday as President Trump was announcing that the U.S. was going to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Do you see any symbolism there that the Secretary of State was not standing next to the president for that announcement, which we know will have consequences around the globe?
It will have tremendous and, I fear, very negative consequences around the globe. And the fact that the Secretary of State first wasn't standing with the president when he made that decision, but also wasn't able to shape it in a way that I think, as I understand from press reports, he tried to do. But here's the other factor. think about the gaps, the vacancies that exist right now. We have no ambassador in Egypt, in Jordan, or in Saudi Arabia. We have no confirmed assistant secretary in the bureau that handles the Middle East. How are we supposed to lead our diplomacy at a time that is everyone is concerned is going to be potentially violent and terribly disruptive? Diplomats across Europe have described Trump's decision yesterday as catastrophic.
Well, do you think that the reason that we don't have diplomats in those places is because of Rex Tillerson or because of President Trump?
I think it's both. And when you look at what's happening to our diplomacy, you have to look both at what I can only describe as Rex Tillerson's mismanagement of the State Department, but also Trump's mangling of our foreign policy.
What about for the people who are working in the State Department right now, not people who have left or have not been replaced, but for the people who are in the State Department, what are things like right now? What's the morale like?
Well, first, let me say I have enormous respect for the career officials who are working away so diligently and so loyally. All of us owe them a tremendous debt of gratitude for what they are doing. At the same time, they are deeply demoralized and dispirited, both because they're missing so many people. When you step up to take your boss's job, for example, so you're acting in that capacity, your own job goes unfilled. And on top of that, what I hear from people in the State Department is that Tillerson has walled himself off from the expertise and the experience of the career people in the State Department. He's got a very small group of political appointees that don't have experience in diplomacy. And one former ambassador has described the situation as a disaster waiting to happen.
A disaster waiting to happen. So what about right now? Is it a disaster at the moment? Are there consequences at the moment?
Well, I think you have to look at what the progression of foreign policy under the Trump administration has been. So let's look at a couple of examples. First of all, we appear to be edging closer to the brink of some sort of nuclear conflict with North Korea. How has that happened in such a short period of time? And then when you look at the fact that there's no ambassador in South Korea, no assistant secretary for East Asia, you start to get a better picture there. Look also to the fact that we're entering the 17th year of a conflict in Afghanistan. Do we have an assistant secretary who's responsible for that region who can help with the details and the complicated nuances of how the conflict is playing out, what kind of post-conflict stabilization we want to have? And then look just at the news of yesterday and today. The decision to recognize Jerusalem and move our embassy there has already sparked violence in the West Bank. Almost every country around the world, with the exception of Israel, but across the Arab world, across all of Europe, to include the Pope, has opposed this decision. How did we get here, and how are we going to navigate forward? And I have to add, the State Department is scrambling to set up task forces today. They've put out a worldwide security alert. They believe that our embassies and our personnel are at much greater risk. And we're doing all of that with diminished staffing and diminished resources.
Nancy McElDowney, what are the long-term consequences of this? Is this the kind of thing, what's happening at the State Department, that let's say that another president comes in with a different secretary of state with different priorities, that they can just reverse all of these moves by the Trump administration and all will be as it was?
If only it were so easy. And here's one of the things that people have to understand. The State Department is a career service. We bring in diplomats, and it takes years for people to become really expert in a region of the world, learn how to speak the language fluently. We've often said in order to get a real expert in the Arab world, it takes 7 years. So we're in a situation now where not only has Rex Tillerson said he's going to cut the budget by 31% and cut the workforce by 8%, but his intake of new diplomats is going down to the lowest level in over 25 5 years. So you don't turn that around overnight. That's why so many people are troubled. That's why so many people have said this is not just an issue about a federal agency in Washington, kind of an inside the Beltway issue. This goes to the very core of our national security, our capacity to operate in the world. It's why everyone is so deeply troubled about what's happening.
So what are your thoughts on the person that the reporting indicates will replace Rex Tillerson, and that would be Mike Pompeo, the CIA director?
Well, I've not met Mike Pompeo, and so I can't give you detailed judgment about him. He's been described as a hawk. He's been described as someone who has rather strong, even extremist views about certain things. And so while many people are troubled about the negative impact of Tillerson's management of the State Department, they've ironically said he's more of a moderate on some of the policy issues, and that replacing Tillerson with Pompeo could potentially make things even worse.
That's Nancy McEldowney, who is at Georgetown University now. Prior to that, she spent 30 years at the U.S. State Department. Nancy, thanks for joining us.
My great pleasure. Thank you.
When we took the show to Missouri in October, we learned about a shelf of limestone that formed eons ago just below modern-day Kansas City. For decades, miners dug that limestone out of the earth and left behind an impressive network of caves. When the mines closed, a new business opened. Here Now's Peter O'Dowd went deep underground and came up with the story.
To get a sense of the scale down here, let's start with some numbers.
It's 160 feet to the surface.
Brian Corwin is manager of underground vaults and storage. He gives me another number, 60,000. That's the square footage of the warehouse he's showing me.
We're going to pop around.
Oh, it's cold in here.
The refrigerated vault's 45 degrees, 35% humidity.
Perfect conditions to store the few hundred thousand or so pieces of Hollywood gold that Corwin stores down here. Again, we're just in a warehouse where there's stacks and stacks and stacks of film canisters. I'm just looking at one of them here. It's a classic film.
It is.
I had to use the beep there because I wasn't supposed to read off the names of the films on these canisters. The storage company promised producers like 20th Century Fox they'd keep the title secret so that bad guys don't steal old copies of some of the most recognizable films in cinematic history. Corwin can only mention two by name.
As far as the older titles, you know, Gone with the Wind, Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea.
I tell Corwin I really want to see one of those films for myself. So he takes me down a long corridor. We're dwarfed by 16-foot racks packed with canisters. And then it's right in front of us.
It's in Italian. It's 35mm color. Gone with the Wind, picture negative.
And this is just one copy because the movie companies want to protect their assets. They want to spread them out across the country. So if something were to happen here with this one, they would have another copy of it somewhere else.
They would.
How long has this film been sitting here? Gone with the Wind is what, 1940-something?
Let me get my Google out and I'll tell you. But no, it's older. We don't retain any type of silver nitrate. The silver nitrate was a dangerous type of film early on, usually black and white, but it was actually flammable. They have special facilities for that.
So this is pretty cool. I mean, is that interesting for you to have all this here?
It is, just because sometimes you'll see the movies come in prior to the actual release, so that's kind of neat.
It is neat, but this storage space is like a single grain of sand on a beach, just one part of a vast underground complex.
Subtropolis is 6.1 million square feet of leased industrial buildings.
Mike Bell is a VP with Hunt Midwest, which owns and leases Subtropolis, an underground city where it's 68 and overcast every day of the year.
About 1,700 people work here on any given day. There's 55 companies. But we're not even halfway built out. We can still add another 8 million square feet of space.
But who even knows what that means? Put that number into context.
If you were to take Arrowhead Stadium,
that's where the Kansas City Chiefs play football.
It would take 42 Arrowhead Stadiums to fill the developed portion of Subtropolis.
How did it all get here?
Great question. So in the early 1940s, this was purely a mining operation. It was they were pulling rock out to produce concrete, asphalt, and just construction materials back in the day.
Limestone.
Limestone, yep. In the 1960s was when the first tenant occurred, and it was a construction company. They just put their equipment here over the wintertime to winterize it because of the natural temperature in the underground. Our first three tenants were Ford, Russell Stover, and Pillsbury.
Today, the U.S. Post Office keeps rare stamps down here. A local food company promotes its cave-aged cheese. But Subtropolis isn't just about storage. I don't know if you like trucks, but this is like truck heaven down here.
This is truck haven.
April Adams is plant manager for Ground Effects, a company that installs bedliners and custom graphics. And she's showing me a line of 2018 Ford F-150s just waiting to get through the gates.
And where we're at right now is actually going to be our automated spray booths. This is where all of our vehicles go through to get their spray on bedliners.
It's a big metal box, it looks like.
It's a giant box.
One by one, the F-150s pull in. A robotic arm swings out and sprays a black foam over the bed. Now, we're underground in a former limestone mine.
Yes, we are.
Is there a benefit to being down here?
There is a benefit to being down here. We have a controlled environment. There's a constant degrees down here, and depending on if it's too cold, you can't really apply a graphic, or if it's too hot, it might warp something.
Now, what's it like for you to work underground every day?
At first, it was very different, but I've been here for about 10 years now, so I don't have to worry about my snow being on my car in the wintertime or raining outside. Probably the only least benefit that I have is I never know if the sun's shining or not.
Don't you? Exactly. And don't you need the sun to shine on you every once in a while?
Every once in a while, but we get nice fluorescent sunshine down here. It's good.
Fluorescent sunshine. The sound of commerce, 160 feet below, Kansas City, Missouri. For Here and Now, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
Give those people some vitamin D. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.